Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets, especially the events at the Air Force Association's 2019 Airspace Cyber Conference and Trade Show are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Ron, welcome back.
Thanks, Vago. Glad to be here.
Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London. Sash, always good to have you on.
Thank you very much, Vago.
And Richard Abulafia of the Teal Group Consultancy. Richard, thanks for being so patient with us today, especially because I think you are contending with a number of kids at your place. So thank you.
Oh, it's certainly worth taking a break from the kids and always a pleasure to be here at any event.
Fantastic. Guys, let's start with the big story at AFA. Obviously, the Air Force's competition for the $85 billion ground-based strategic deterrent contract to modernize the nation's ground-based Minuteman ICBM force. The service had selected Boeing and Northrop Grumman for the final phase of that competition. Boeing decided against bidding, seeking to team with Northrop Grumman. Northrop Grumman, after talks, declined to partner with Boeing. And then Boeing at the AFA show launched a campaign to try to force the Air Force to force Northrop to accept Boeing as a teammate. The Air Force acquisition chief, Will Roper, has said the Air Force would welcome a bid from Boeing, but also would award the contract on a sole source basis. Ron, I want to start with you. I think Boeing is concerned that the Air Force is going to maintain data rights on the contract, as one would expect on a strategic nuclear deterrent, right? I mean, this isn't TX. Trainer program, and that Northrop has an unfair advantage on the program because of its acquisition of Orbital ATK. And there's a sense that folks have that Boeing bought into the KC-46 tanker, which has been very, very costly given it's a fixed price program. The company took charges after winning the MQ-25 refueling aircraft and then the TX trainer. And in the wake of the 737 MAX issue, which has been extremely costly, there's a sense that Boeing just doesn't have a lot of maneuvering room. How does this latest Boeing maneuver fit in more broadly into recent events? What does it tell the Air Force? And more importantly, what does it tell markets?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's try to dissect it, a couple different parts here. Could Boeing, is Boeing truly at a disadvantage on this? Honestly, I mean, it's hard to say, right? I mean, Northrop did the acquisition of, Orbital ATK to get access to, I guess, the solid rocket stage of this. There was a consent decree that, Northrop had to supply that. I guess Boeing's issue becomes, right, I mean, Northrop is making margin on what they would sell them, right? So ultimately, it would presumably make their bid more expensive. But, Boeing and Northrop and the Air Force and whoever else looked at the deal when Northrop did it, had to know that, right? So, to have Boeing pull out sort of when they did, it couldn't have been that much of a surprise given the industry dynamics. They seem to be falling back more on a political maneuver than actual, business fundamentals in terms of a product offering or something else. I mean, as you know, it's better than anybody. I mean, the Air Force has seemed to indicate they could be comfortable with one source. What we saw fall out of the Air Force conference, Boeing is actually teaming with the other guys, right? So Lockheed Martin is on their team, General Dynamics is on their team, a lot of other companies, I forgot the whole litany of companies that are on their team. So it's Northrop leading a team that actually has other primes on it and other meaningful contractors. When it came out that this was playing out, I think it had more of an impact on Northrop, obviously, than it did on Boeing. I do get calls from investors who are, curious at how this will play out, because ultimately, if this does end up being a Northrop sole source and nearly sole source, where they're the lead contractor, it's quite good for Northrop, right? Because they'll have two legs of the strategic deterrent, right? I mean, they'll be on the air-based piece and the land-based piece. For their outlook, as you look out over a very long period of time, it's a huge positive. In terms of, Boeing's strategy around this, for sure, 737's costing them a lot. But they have a very big balance sheet. The balance sheet isn't really stretched, right? So I, for one, don't particularly believe that this has so much to do with a lack of wiggle room on because of 737. And then again, I'm not saying to say that 737 doesn't hurt. It does, but they have a huge balance sheet and they have room if they wanted to stretch it. So my sense is this has just more to do with, I mean, I hate to say it, but maybe sour grapes or something else. But why don't I leave it there and see what everybody else has to say.
Richard, your view?
Yeah, you know, first of all, complete agreement with everything Ron said, of course. Just to take it slightly further back, Boeing Defense does not at all have a weak position, but they have become heavily dependent upon buckets for, well, capture. And they're all sort of held together by the loose theme of leverage, leveraging work done. Three buckets, one being leveraging Boeing Commercial, KC-46 and P-8. Number two, leveraging other people's platform design and integration capabilities, MH-139 and TX. And then finally, leveraging the past, F-15EX and Super Hornet ongoing production. The idea of investing and generating core capabilities, sort of doubling down on engineering and that doesn't seem to have entered the picture here. And yet they're certainly capable of it. God knows by the big investments they've made in unmanned, like with the, in situ and Aurora, that shows that they can. And of course, as Ron says about their balance sheet, they can. In this case, they have not. It does appear to be a bit more of a political maneuver, and it doesn't, GBSD does not appear to be something you can pursue with leverage of other people's work in the other, as in the case of the other three buckets. So I just don't think this is something they're going to get.
Liquid Robotics, right? I mean, that was another really good investment of an extraordinary capability that's filled out Boeing's capacities as an unmanned systems provider. But Ron, let me go back to you. Do you think that the Air Force is going to knuckle under on this? Because the Boeing guy's messaging on it was, well, the Air Force is begging us and we're just not going to come in on this, was what one of their executives told me. And then when you talk to the Air Force, they didn't seem to be begging. They, Dr. Roper, when he spoke to reporters, knew the optics of it. So he was like, hey, we're very happy to have Northrop in as a bidder. On the other hand, we've awarded contracts to sole source providers. Do you think that ultimately in the end of the day, the Air Force is going to stick to its guns? And what are the implications if it doesn't?
I clearly can't speak on behalf of the Air Force. However,
right.
They had to know when the orbital ATK deal happened, the industry structure from that point. So this couldn't have surprised anybody. And my sense is from your conversations and other conversations that have happened, I don't think they're gonna cave on it, right? I mean, I think they're pretty clear on their expectation and how they expect this to play out. I'll be astonished if it doesn't play out that way. And you have a third factor too, I'm certain, that the Air Force probably wants to, mitigate as much risk on this as they can before the election, right? Because, come election, that puts some uncertainty in the system, potentially delays, that kind of thing. So I'm certain they're going to want to get this all nailed down and done. They're not going to want to back up. They're not going to want to have it take much longer. And they've been pretty crystal clear about their expectations. One further point, the way Boeing tends to, a lot of times for good reasons, you can understand why sometimes they do it, messages to the external world, sometimes different than reality, right? And, reminded of that recently on the 737 MAX program. We're reminded of that in a big way on Tanker, right? It's fine. It's great. You keep have all these charges going on. We're reminded of that on 787, right? I mean, 787 was... it was going to fly and then it couldn't and so on and so forth. You know the whole story. So I'm not surprised they're being aggressive the way they are in their messaging because that's how they message.
Richard, do you think the Air Force will bend or do you think the Air Force will stick to its guns? Or do you think that politically Boeing, which has been a very, very astute and savvy contractor, is going to be able to compel somehow the Air Force? there are folks who are talking about Adam Smith. Obviously, he's in Washington State, and you know, in the Seattle area, right, where Boeing is very, very large, and he's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. How do you think this is going to play out?
You know, it seems Boeing, of course, does have a great deal of political clout and political savvy, but boy, there are better places to put those resources, and they can't be everywhere. Obviously, there are so many challenges on the regulatory and political front right now, and the probability of a kill here doesn't seem very high at all. So if they're wise, they'll use those resources elsewhere. You know, I think another aspect that the Air Force, you know, might just consider is that if they do, as Ron said, give Northrop Grumman, you know, two of the three legs of the triad, they don't have to worry about anyone messaging either way or the other. You know, they can make resource allocations on the basis of strategic thinking rather than contractors. So it probably appeals to them just having that kind of one company doing both. I think there's so many things about it that appeal, and I think Northrop's done a very good job going after this contract. So again, I would, if I were Boeing, I would use their very considerable political clout elsewhere.
Look, I mean, you know, in fairness, B-21 is being held up as a model program. So Boeing, at least Northrop Grumman, has that in their favor. And looking at it from the Air Force's perspective, especially with an uncertain, you know, nobody knows who's going to win the election. There's a sense that the Air Force wants this buttoned down and under contract before potentially Democrats would be in a position, given so many of them are questioning the nuclear modernization agenda. Sash, let me bring you in on this, because you have a very astute eye for, you know, how things look politically. From your standpoint, how does this all look politically? Does it look as bad to you watching from over there as it does to some folks here in Washington?
I think for a program of this scale, and you know, from the point of view of Boeing's defense business, it's not existential, but it's, you know, this is a heritage part of the Boeing defense franchise. I can understand why they will fight tooth and nail. What I just didn't understand was why they withdrew in the, you know, or you know, no bid in the first place with, you know, such poor grace. That seemed to me to be guaranteed to lose friends and lose support at a very early stage, when for a program like this, you actually need to keep people on side. And thinking that you can just sort of strong arm your way through the process, it just feels misguided to me.
Before we move on and go to the commercial market, because I know, Ron, you were in Toulouse at the Speed News Conference, and Richard, you wrote a piece in Aviation Week about the commercial cycle, and Sash would like to get your view on that as well. But just to finish off, Will Roper, the Air Force Acquisition Chief, continuously talks about the Digital Century Series, obviously an homage to the Century Series fighter programs in the early days of jets in the U.S. Air Force, and that sort of building block approach to building and fielding capability. And he seems to think that smaller blocks, that advances in manufacturing capability and advances in digital architectures, can allow you to build smaller batches of much more tailor-made aircraft very quickly, operate them for an X number of years, junk them, and go to a new generation, which may be a better approach than vast fleets of very, very large airplanes. We talked about that a little bit on the last podcast when we had Air Force Magazine's John Turpak and Aviation Week's Steve Trimble on the program. What's your sense? I mean, what are some of the key takeaways from your standpoint? But if you listen to it, what Will Roper wants to do is fundamentally change how the industry operates to make it more agile, introduce more competition. What's your sense in how that's all going to play out?
From my standpoint, you know, if you'd asked me what the megatrends were in combat aircraft design and how they'd influence the next generation of platforms, this is pretty much the exact opposite of the conclusions I would reach. You know, first of all, what do we really need to know about airframe manufacturing? Not a great deal. Where are we learning all the interesting stuff? Well, the subsystems, the weapons, the sensors, whatever else. What are the other really promising trends? Well, definitely loyal wingmen. Anything to do with, you know, adjunct fleets of small drones and slightly larger than drones, semi-expendables and whatever else that can accompany a crewed platform into combat. what do we need from specialized airframes? Not really a lot here. So I really don't understand any of this, to be honest. It might be a bit of a reaction or maybe an overreaction to the kind of ginormous NGAD platform that was emerging, you know, sort of like a super F-22 from hell, like an FB-111. That might have been a bit much. But going back to the Century series, for what gain or purpose? I mean, back in the Century series, we just didn't know that much about jet airframes or indeed how to build them. And there were lots of different requirements that weren't mergeable because multi-role hadn't been really invented back then. I would argue we're in a completely different place that argues for a completely different solution.
And I think in fairness, Richard, right, I mean, I think Dr. Roper is looking both on the system side of things as well as on the aerostructure side of things. I think trying to leverage and harness technology and open architectures to develop and advance kind of the state of the art of modern kind of combat aircraft, including for NGAD, which is the next generation air dominance program that's so important as the sort of the successor to F-22, if you will.
Ron, sure, I guess if I could just follow on to that, then it would seem to me, I'm sure that's right, and I'm sure his intentions are very good there. It just seems to me that that's the case. One of the great benefits of open architecture and that kind of layout is that systems become more upgradable. In which case, why would you want relatively short lifespans for platforms? You'd want the opposite of that, wouldn't you?
Well, I think so. The sense is that when aircraft go into rework and upgrade at whether it's their D check or X thousand hours, it becomes very, very expensive. And so it may be cheaper to actually get rid of the airplane, but you know, have common systems and common subsystems on them and just sort of refresh and just build a new airplane instead of going through all the work of remanufacturing it. So Ron, from your standpoint about what do you know, obviously from airplane engineering and manufacturing and design and aerodynamics as you do, I mean, is Dr. Roper onto something that he's saying, look, you know, instead of building vast runs of aircraft that are compromises in order to try to hit this, right? F-35 is a tremendous airplane, but it's a compromise. That you may be better off tailoring aircraft to specific missions as long as you can get common subsystems, common connectivity, you know, an X number of power plants that you can rely on. I mean, would that be a potentially appropriate and revolutionary approach that's better synced to the kind of agility we need for the future?
It sounds good. However, the devil's always in the details, right? And as you know, with aircraft, particularly, you know, tactical aircraft, military aircraft, special mission aircraft, a lot of times you don't have a lot of margin for weight or for whatever. So, you know, if it's got a common systems, IT system architecture, maybe, right? Because you have embedded computing, you have common embedded computing and so on and so forth. But when you start talking about the platform itself, and let's use landing gear as an example, you'd think, oh, hey, maybe you can use landing gear on different platforms. But then the landing gear all of a sudden starts becoming very specific to the platform, because the platform itself might change, you have different weight characteristics. And I think, you know, the compromises that you make and ultimately why F-35 is just this big, broad compromise is because, you know, you were trying to do multiple missions. So I think it sounds good. And maybe there are some cases where you can apply it, but because of the margin that you have on almost any system, you know, on an airplane, I think actually applying it makes it really difficult.
I've got sort of 1.5 points to make, which is that I think that what is coming out of this is that the Air Force and the DoD are beginning to realize that competition is really, really good, and it keeps costs low and it keeps innovation coming into the system at a pretty good pace, which is exactly what we don't have with the F-35. And I think that the big, or you know, one of the big sins of the F-35 was getting rid of the alternative General Electric Rolls-Royce engine so early in the process and saying, look, we'll just stick with the Pratt & Whitney engine for the whole damn thing. With a production run of 5,000 aircraft, you can afford to have two engines. Once you've got two engines, you get the benefits that in terms of, I mean, you still have a huge number of common systems. The engines are common across, let's say, 2,000 of those aircraft, and the other guy gets, you know, the 3,000. But you get the benefits of two competitors constantly needling each other to get better and get cheaper. And that's exactly what the US has lost with the F-35 program. And it seems to me that talking about a new century series of aircraft, apart from the benefits of going back to mission-focused aircraft rather than jacks of all trades, is you're bringing competition back in again.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's the number one thing he's looking for. And of course, anybody who knows about the great engine wars knows the F-100 was a great engine, but the competition from the F-110 from General Electric proved to be very, very important in trying to control costs and driving technology forward for both of those products.
It made the F-100 a better engine.
If I could just quickly interject, this battle is far from over. You've got the XA-100, I believe, and the XA-101 coming from Pratt and GE with the idea under the Advent program, with the idea of fitting them into the F-35 as competitive motors.
Absolutely, and a lot of investment, obviously, right from the company in trying to do that. And you could argue that Pratt & Whitney, a great company, sees that competition over its shoulder and keeps updating and making the F-135 engine more competitive. And now a word from our sponsor. The Defense and Aerospace Report is brought to you by the Bell V-280 Valor, bringing the mission technology of the future to the battlefield of today. Visit bellflight.com for more. Let's shift to commercial right now because time is short and there's a lot to discuss. Sash, we have to also discuss the new Franco-German tensions as well as the Thales big win in Switzerland. Ron, let's go to you. You were in Toulouse at the Speed News Conference. What were some of your key takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple key things. The Boeing's been messaging a certain time frame for the MAX's entry into service that we'll see a submission to the FAA of some sort of finished proposal, whatever it is, in September, and we could be back into service by sometime in the fourth quarter. Probably early in the first quarter. The takeaway from the conference was, I would say, broadly among the suppliers that I had conversations with there and some of the presentations that the FAA might not conclude everything until maybe as late as the first quarter of next year. And then EASA, because they want to do some independent flight testing, independent analysis, they might have a different requirement for training, and they're still not yet comfortable with the flight control system based on the two angled attack sensors. That might not happen until sometime late in Q2, maybe Q3, and that's later than I think most people, at least in the market, are expecting. There was a lot of discussion at the conference around a slowing cycle. Richard wrote an interesting article about that this week, so I'll let him talk about that. But, I would say the expectation at the conference is, among the suppliers was, hey, you know what? Air traffic's been slowing. Order activity's been slowing. Maybe the best days are behind us. Folks weren't, running for cover saying the sky was falling. There's this expectation of a soft landing, but that maybe the best days are really behind us. And then, maybe one last point, and I think this is an interesting one because we really haven't talked about it much on this podcast, is the impact that environmental concerns, travel shaming, that kind of thing could have on air traffic growth was more pervasive through a lot of the conversations and presentations at this conference than probably any other I've been to. Now, maybe part of that was the location, but also maybe we really are starting to get to a tipping point in terms of concerns around air travel. And so anyway, I guess the point is that the concern is it could maybe be a headwind for air traffic growth on a go forward basis, depending on how you view it.
Richard, you were the guy who a long time your presentation was that cycle, what cycle? The cycle is over. The cycle is back. It was just semi-dormant, right? Tell us where you stand right now and your recent piece.
Well, in my own modest defense,
I'm not doing a Jacques, by the way, at all. So
I think I had indeed thought that the bust part of the cycle had been vanquished for some time, possibly permanently, as long as we managed our affairs well. If we got clumsy, say with overproduction or some other problem, then yes, it could, hell hath no fury like a cycle scorned. It could be back. now, you've got, I think, sort of two issues that are really worth paying attention to. While we've been paying attention to the sort of top line trend lines you associate with a cycle and talk of cyclicality. In reality, things have really shifted. Twin aisles peaked years ago. And right now this is an industry that rather than being 50% singles, 50% twins, it's more like 70-30 or something like that. So everything we're talking about is dependent upon the A320 series and the 737 series. And obviously the second of those has got its own set of headwinds. So we're in a very vulnerable place. And the other thing people should pay attention to, obviously, as chronicled by IATA and of course, Ron, his always essential notes, is that it's been six really grim and frankly inexplicable months of terrible traffic. And we're concerned about that. But on top of that, so far, orders this year, net orders come to a monstrous 10, which means we're on course to have the worst orders year in a quarter of a century. That's really bad because, as Ron says, there's a lot depends upon people's confidence. They're willing to invest in the future and not getting a lot of positives out there right now.
And it doesn't help that all Boeing carriers like Southwest are beginning to fundamentally reconsider their strategy, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and I wonder if there won't be read across for other people. Maybe you could even regard the Century series as exactly the same thing. You know, maybe the single fleet type philosophy just puts you in a vulnerable spot, whether it's a 737 MAX or it's an F-35.
Right.
And that could easily be something that comes out of it. Relying on the 737 in the past for 40 years or longer really has been a winning strategy. Now people are starting to question it.
Sash?
I think people underestimate the degree to which, in terms of orders this year, it's a worse year by, you know, a large degree than 2009. And 2009 was a really, really dreadful year for orders. And even if you exclude all of the 737 MAXs that are just going in storage, Boeing and Airbus, they've got these fantastic order backlogs, which they are consuming respectively at a rate of 800 aircraft a year. So those order backlogs are going from giving them huge visibility and they can just be really comfortable about the near term to having some programs, particularly wide bodies, where the visibility is starting to look pretty lousy, more than about 2 years out. And that starts to cause the manufacturers to have to make some very, very difficult decisions about production. And our view is that we're going to see production cuts rather than production rises taking place, and that those production cuts, they'll start at wide bodies, but eventually you'll see the narrow bodies stall and then the narrow bodies start to come down again. That's not been the narrative in this industry for well over a decade, but things have fundamentally changed as a result of, you know, what Richard says, six awful months of traffic and six truly dreadful months of net orders for Boeing and Airbus.
So when do you think this is going to manifest in a slowdown, right? Because everybody you talk to, right? We talked to Duane Hawkins, who, I mean, obviously he's on the defense side of the business at Spirit AeroSystems, one of the absolute key manufacturers on 737. They're still producing at 52 and they're looking at a ramp decision to go higher, right? Which has always been Boeing's intention. When are we going to see brakes being applied to this?
To some extent, I mean, think about it. We have had, you know, very few 737s delivered this year, and the global airline industry has adjusted to it, I would argue, actually quite well. You know, given the slowdown in traffic, that the 737 kind of picked an optimal time to run into the problems that it did, and the industry has adjusted. If traffic were to stay light, I don't think you're going to see any airline in the world line up and say, yeah, just throw all that capacity at me. They're not going to, right? And the aircraft that have been produced are going to sit in inventory longer. So I think point one, on the 737 side, you've already seen some impact of it where the industry's adjusted. And then I think you're going to possibly could see another impact by the end of the year. If Boeing doesn't firm up more 787 orders by the end of the year, my best guess is they will signal they will cut production, right? And I wouldn't be surprised if they signal that before the end of the year, that they go from 14 to 12 or whatever it is. Because if you look at that backlog and you get out to 2022, it falls off pretty sharply.
Richard?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. Having said that, a lot of people, of course, look at output just from the standpoint of, you know, revenue, and that's good. And, oh, look, there's still an upward trend line in deliveries, if only from the raw ship set numbers. And it's hard to put the brakes on right now. I mean, the snapback we'll see in deliveries over the next 2 years is probably going to be pretty profound. Now, unfortunately, that happy trend line is going to mask over a number of other horrors, including, of course, as Ron says, the inevitable downshift from 14 per month on 787s. Already you had Dennis Muilenburg talking about, well, we need China orders to maintain that rate. Well, no, even if you get them, China's not going to make a material difference in that calculation. There's just overcapacity in twin aisles right now. That's also true for the only other healthy twin aisle program, the A350, and all the other twin aisles. Oh boy, you know, it's just not a happy environment. So I would argue you'll see continued softness, continued downward trends in twin aisles, and single aisles, again, it's going to be masked over by the 737 MAX snapback, as well as, frankly, just really fantastic numbers on 320neo, particularly for 321neo. It's, it used to be tied for, you know, in equal place with the MAX or with the 737 for decades now, and now it's far and away the single most important jetliner in the world by a wide margin.
Very quickly, let's talk a little bit about the Franco-German dynamic, how that's going. Obviously, Paris, Berlin, and Madrid all partnered on one combat aircraft program, but some concerns about export controls and how that's going to affect not just the prospects on something like Eurofighter, but how it's going to affect and shape this very, very ambitious multinational future combat aircraft program.
There's been some very interesting press comment coming out of France in the last week, just about how difficult the negotiations are between the French and the German sides over leadership of the various components of the Franco-German SCAF, FCAS, combat aircraft program. The particular snags at the moment appear to be in the engine. And, you know, what we're talking about there is, I think that SNECMA Safran expected to lead and probably dominate the engine, with MTU really majoring on overhaul of the engine thereafter. And clearly that narrative just doesn't play very well in Germany. And MTU is saying, you know, this is a shared responsibility. This is there has to be shared management of the engine. And that's giving the French some concerns. I just don't think they expected the Germans to be pushing to have shared control of this program at quite such an early stage. There's another narrative as well, which is what happens about exports of this aircraft, and indeed, you know, Franco-German programs in general. The French are really concerned, and we've talked about this a lot, about whether they will have the freedom of maneuver to export the aircraft. And the paradox here is that the case study that's being brought up by some of the better informed journalists is the case of an armored vehicle export to Qatar, where actually the French have won with the VBCI, the 8x8 wheeled vehicle, which is a very, very impressive vehicle indeed. And then, you know, DSCI, they had a particularly heavily armed variant of that with the 40mm CTA cannon, and it's a really, really good. But what's particularly interesting there is that I think the more perceptive French journalists are highlighting that actually they damn near lost the Qatari contract to the Germans, to Rheinmetall with the Boxer, which is also a really impressive 8x8, and that it was only German export restrictions that allowed the French to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. So there was a contract they thought they had probably 2-3 years ago. The Germans came in relatively late with a very competitive offering, but it was the arms controls that limited them. And that what I think is coming out of the French Ministry of Defense is, hey, you know, it's the arms controls that are, or the export controls that are limiting German industry. And if we are teamed, you know, inescapably with Germany on SCAF, SCAF, FCAS, we are going to be limited by the controls the Germans put on the on the program. That's not something we've ever had to put up with before. So, you know, you could argue this is just more of the same, but it's been very interesting how, you know, analytic the coverage has been of this week.
Which shouldn't be surprising to anybody, given that we've been having some of these conversations for a very long time. And very quickly, tell us what the Thales victory in Switzerland could mean.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting one. The Swiss have got an all-encompassing air defense competition. And the competition extends from command and control system, which is clearly C2 plus the radars, through to missiles. Remember, the Swiss have got a lot of Rapier missiles. They're pretty long on the tooth now. They used to be a big operator of Bloodhound, which is, you know, brings tears to my eyes. Anyway, there's a real nostalgia missile. And then
it brought tears to the eyes of a lot of its operators as well, because of its simplicity
very
of maintenance.
Very true.
Sorry, I couldn't help but say that. Sorry. Great name. Great name, though, for a system. Sweden had them, right? Very, very popular on the export market.
Singapore,
but you were saying.
So, yeah. And this all ties into the fighter competition. So Thales wins this week the command and control contract. Does that then give them an advantage on the radar? Does that then, because, you know, command and control system radars tend to go, they tend to be very closely tied together. Does that then give them an advantage on the missile in terms of the Aster-based SAMP-T system? Does this make the job of Patriot, and hence Raytheon, much harder because they've lost the first stage of the whole air defense contract? And ultimately, does this then skew the competition for the fighter? I don't think I can judge that last question, but I do think that this is going to make Raytheon's job in terms of Patriot much, much harder than it would have been otherwise.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Great to be here, Vago.
Thanks, Auge.
Thanks very much, Vago.
Thanks for joining us this week. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Check out our gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Air Force Association's Air, Space, Cyber Conference and Trade Show outside Washington, D.C., where our coverage was sponsored by L3Harris and Leonardo DRS, including Acting U.S. Air Force Secretary Matt Donovan, Vice Chief of Staff General Sevi Wilson, Pacific Air Forces Commander General C.Q. Brown, U.S. Air Forces in Europe Commander General Cobra Harigian, Air Combat Command Commander General Mobile Holmes, Air National Guard Director, Lieutenant General Catfish Rice, Air Force Reserve, Lieutenant General Richard Scobie, L3Harris Communications President, Dana Maynard, and many more. Check out our coverage of the DSCI Conference and Trade Show in London, where our coverage was sponsored by L3Harris and Leonardo DRS in partnership with Clarion Events, the organizer of DSCI and many other flagship events around the world, and working with the UK Department of International Trade's Defense and Security Organization to bring you the very best in British defense. Follow us on Twitter at DefAero Report. That's at DefAero Report. Like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. The Defense and Aerospace Report podcast is sponsored by Bell. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight. BellFlight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again next week.